fascism doesn't just show up out of nowhere. You can see it slowly but surely coming, and the first hint of it, you got to jump on it, you got to crush it, because if you don't, it will jump on and crush you.
Welcome to episode 12 of Inside Without Now, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with RefuseFascism.org. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of this podcast. If you're listening, you're probably already aware of how dangerous the Trump-Pence regime is. On top of the federal troops that have been sent out to brutalize protesters in Portland and delegitimize and replace local authorities with even more repressive federal forces in other cities like Chicago. This past Friday night, the regime drastically reorganized the U.S. Postal Service, which is the institution that is facilitating vote by mail. There is no pretense behind any of this, at least none that a thinking person should buy. It's in our faces. They're planning on holding power no matter what. There is no sense in waiting until after the election happens to demand that this fascist regime be removed from power. While we wait, they are plotting and organizing their supporters who have already shown themselves to be willing and able to use violence, even while their guy is still in office. Relying on the upcoming elections without a mass struggle now to demand the removal of the regime is a mistake with catastrophic consequences for people in this country and around the world. We cannot wait for the Trump-Pence regime to further delegitimize and degrade the elections. So we are not waiting, and we're calling on all of you to join us in the streets demanding Trump and Pence must go now. This week, we're sharing excerpts from a live stream Q&A session with members of the RefuseFascism.org editorial board, along with commentary from an online meeting talking about the need for and the ways to make a powerful nationwide day of protests happen this coming Labor Day weekend, Saturday, September 5. If you have questions about why and how this could actually happen, you don't want to miss this. You can find out more about the plans for September 5 and how you can participate at RefuseFascism.org, starting immediately. But first, we'll listen to an interview I did with Michael Cord. Michael is a criminal defense attorney, activist, and host of Radio Courtroom, which airs each Sunday on WURD Radio. He is also the self-proclaimed angriest black man in America. You can follow him on Twitter at Michael Cord and read his articles at phillytrib.com. I wanted to start with a question. You fought against white supremacy for decades. Your passion for justice and uprooting white supremacy didn't begin with Trump's presidency. Mm-hmm. Some people are saying that what we're seeing now is just more of the same. All presidents have been racist, that kind of thing. Can you speak to, in particularity with white supremacy, but overall with fascism, what do you see as different from what Trump is and represents?
I actually wrote an article shortly after Trump was elected. And everybody was bashing Trump, and so was I. But the thing I did different from most people is I captioned my article as this: Trump is America, and America is Trump. So when we see a Donald Trump, he's not really an aberration. Donald Trump is what I call America's dirty kitchen. What I mean by that is, from a distance, all kitchens look beautiful, and you assume they got delicious food inside. But as you get closer and turn the light on, you see there's roaches everywhere. and rats everywhere. But from a distance, America appears to be that wonderful kitchen. But the thing that Trump has done, unlike any other president, he's allowed the light to be turned on about America. So I want to be clear that Trump is not really an aberration. Trump is America on steroids in front of your face. Even though clearly Hillary Clinton beat him by about 3 million votes, he got 61 million Americans to vote for him. So what does that tell you? So when we talk about the fascism and what I see, I've always accused America of being engaged in a creeping fascism. And I always start out by trying to define what I mean, because when you use the word fascism, people think that you're engaging in hyperbole. They think that, now it's not like, you know, you got stormtroopers inside your house with a machine gun to your head. Well, not quite, but we're moving in that direction. So let me start by defining fascism as I see it. And I break it down by saying it involves violence. I'm going to apply that to Trump. It involves ultranationalism. I'm going to apply that to Trump. It involves authoritarianism. I'm going to apply that to Trump. It applies to right-wing political ideology. I'll apply that to Trump. And it's manifested in a cultish kind of blind allegiance to a leader. And then finally, it engages in a nostalgic type of approach to the country. So what I mean by all that, we talk about violence, Donald Trump at his rallies has actually told his supporters, knock people in the head, told cops to rough people up. So clearly a violence is there and irrefutable. When I say ultra-nationalist, he defined himself out of his own mouth as a nationalist. So we got that there. We then moved to whether he's an authoritarian. Well, you can see that authoritarians tend to engage in purges and they want loyalty. That's exactly what he's done. I have no admiration for any Republican in the history of the United States of America, but some who were aligned with him realized he wasn't going the right way. And what did he do? He purged them. So that's when the authoritarianism comes in. We talk about right-wing ideology. That's on his face. That's even well beyond the standard Republican ideology. And then we talk about a cultist blind allegiance to a leader. I think maybe once before the 2016 election, I engaged in debate with a Trump supporter. Just once. And then I realized that I can't make any headway. I could say 1 + 1 = 2, and they would engage me in debates. I'm like, why am I wasting my time? So when I talk about that culture's blind allegiance, that's the maggots. And then when I talk about wallowing in nostalgic approach to the past, about a societal rebirth, that's exactly what the maggot thing is, make America great again. So when I use the word fascism, I mean it in the dictionary definition sense and the political definition sense. The only difference between Trump and past presidents is that he's much more blatant about it. You know, we look at, for example, the Patriot Act from 2001, and we condemn what that means and what that meant for America. We look at the authorization of military use, again passed in 2001. We look at what President Barack Obama did with the National Defense Authorization Act. So all these presidents have moved us closer to the brink, but instead of creeping toward the brink, Trump is sprinting toward the brink. And I'm just hoping that, again, without engaging in too much hyperbole, that people in America today, 2020, look back and say, what did Italians do in Italy before 1922? What did Germans do in Germany before 1933 or even 1921? What did the Spanish people do in Spain before 1936? Fascism doesn't just show up out of nowhere. You can see it slowly but surely coming, and the first hint of it, you got to jump on it, you got to crush it, because if you don't, it will jump on and crush you.
I really appreciate that. I think that there was a lot of substance to what you were saying, and I think people defining it and understanding what it means is really critical, because if you're not identifying at this point that this is fascist, I don't know where your head is at. I think your point about there becomes a time where it's too late is absolutely right. you talked a lot about the violence, right? And the crushing mm-hmm. of dissent. And I was wondering, why is this violence towards protest so central to fascism?
When you look at America in 2020, you see heavily armed, camouflaged federal paramilitary forces in the city streets, you're thinking this just can't be. It just can't be that there would be a secret, heavily armed, camouflaged paramilitary force in a city street in the North in America in 2020. The fact that that exists is chilling and frightening. And I always say to people in response to that, be afraid, be very afraid, and then resist. And that's what I'm hoping that you and I can get people to do, to be afraid, to be very afraid, and then, damn it, do something about it.
Yeah, I think this idea that we hear a lot about you're being an alarmist. Well, is it true that the alarm should be sounded? And if that's the case, shouldn't we be sounding it with every bone in our being to stop this American Hitler? And I think that is positively the case right now.
Absolutely. And I love the word alarm there, because although much that we think we know about American history is based on myth, but let's say for the sake of argument that Paul Revere in 1775 did yell, the British are coming, the British are coming. Well, he was alarming the 13 colonies about the British coming. Here in America today, you and I are telling people the fascists are here. They're right here. We're talking about the fascists right here, right now. I mean, there are media personalities talking about it, but we should literally be pulling our hair out. The fact, as I said, that secret, heavily armed, paramilitary federal forces are on American streets kidnapping and assaulting people. Where do they do that in America in 2020? Well, under Trump, they do it in Portland, and talking about sending it throughout the country, including Philadelphia.
You know, when you look at Operation Legend in particular, and you look at the cities being targeted, what do all these cities have in common? Majority Black population. What does law and order mean in that context? It means the law and order of fascism. It means this overt, naked white supremacists in the White House seeking to further demonize and terrorize Black communities, as someone who is campaigning on the Confederacy, and this being totally normal.
That's the thing. It's totally normal. You would think that because America was so discreet and shrewd in its fascism, in its racism, in its classism, white male patriarchy can think certain things, but the rule is never say it out loud. Well, Trump is saying it out loud, and he's not blurting it out spontaneously. This is a deliberate decision he made. He knows that there's a strong undercurrent of white people in America who believes what he believes. So he's talking to them. He's hoping that they see these stormtroopers in the street and they rally around him as the great leader. So the fact that politically this could work is absolutely frightening. You would think that any other candidate, but for me, frightening means we just fight back that much harder.
As a lawyer, what have you seen in terms of the legal sphere that illustrates this sprint towards fascism that you think people should be paying attention to?
As an attorney, I don't go to court to get justice because there's very little there. Instead, I go to court to expose the injustice because there's so much there. And if I'm effective in exposing the injustice, then indirectly, my client might ultimately get some justice. As a lawyer, I have very little respect for the law because I know the law is based on rules created by the haves against the have-nots. I mean, any type of crime you can think about, there's crimes which on their face are horrible, murder and robbery and rape. And then there are what we lawyers call, there's malum in se and malum prohibitum. Without getting too technical, malum in se laws are laws pertaining to stuff that's just bad on its face. Murder, robbery, rape. Those things should be illegal. Then you got malum prohibitum, things that are bad because the law says it's bad, like gambling. Nothing wrong inherently with gambling. Prostitution, If I want to sell my body, who's to stop me? So there's certain types of law, but when white folks from Europe came onto Turtle Island, what we call America, they murdered, they robbed, they raped, they pillaged. And then once they committed genocide against the red people, then they bring in the black people to the labor. And now for everybody else, it's illegal to do the very same thing that brought them to power. You look at the legal system anywhere where there have been oppressive laws. For me, the law doesn't matter. What matters is justice. And people say, well, how could you as a lawyer say the law doesn't matter? Well, slavery was legal in America. Women not being able to vote was legal in America. The Holocaust in Germany was legal. Apartheid in South Africa was legal. Just because you have some laws doesn't end the question. That simply begins the question. And again, when I speak to people, I try to speak in a way where they understand that even though what I'm saying sounds alarmist, it sounds crazy, there's facts behind it. Look at the laws here in America. 1619, slavery as we know it in America began on August 25, 1619, when 20 to 30 blacks from Angola were brought to the colony of Virginia and enslaved. And there were laws concerning that. That's 1619, the first laws, the first rules, the first legislation affecting black people. Then we fast forward to 1776, the founding of this country, where there were 56 white male property owners that signed the Declaration of Independence. 41 of those 56, that's 75% of them, were involved in the slave trade. Fast forward to 1789, the adoption of the US Constitution. Three blatantly racist clauses built into the Constitution, continuing the importation of black folks to be enslaved. That's in the Constitution. Three-fifths law, that's in the Constitution. And the runaway return clause saying if a black person left the slave territory, escaped to a free territory, the free territory had to send them back. This is all in the Constitution. 1857, the Dred Scott decision. Black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect. The 1783 Supreme Court case strengthened the Dred Scott decision. 2016, just 4 years ago, the Attorney General for the state of Kansas filed a legal brief citing the Dred Scott decision to support his argument. The state Attorney General of Kansas did this in 2016. Why? Because he knew that the Dred Scott decision of 1857 has never been judicially overturned. There's never been any court in the United States, including this year, 2020, that ever overturned the Dred Scott decision that black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect. So when I look at that, when I look at the US Supreme Court in 2013, gutted the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Yeah, I'm a lawyer, but I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid. And as a criminal defense attorney, I look at the 13th Amendment, which as a black person I'm supposed to embrace, because supposedly it says slavery is hereby abolished. But it doesn't say that. If anybody ever read the 13th Amendment, it clearly says slavery and involuntary servitude are hereby abolished, not exclamation point, not period, but comma, except following conviction for a crime. That means the 13th Amendment opened the door for mass incarceration. So I today, as an attorney in 2020, I got to deal with the implication of that, with mass incarceration, with mandatory sentencing, with racist criminal injustice. So the reality of me on the ground as a frontline soldier in the courtroom, I see it every single day. And when we talk about Black Lives Matter, we really need to start in the so-called criminal injustice system. To be black and conscious in America is to be in a constant state of rage. And I won't smile until there's some substantive changes in America in terms of both race and class.
And a lot more people should be in that same boat. There should be a lot more rage. And I guess my last question, Michael, is what potential do you see in removing this regime? What do you think that people who oppose this fascism that is embodied by Trump, what should we be doing?
I vented throughout this interview about the problems, now offer some solution. Well, I hate to admit that I'm encouraging people to vote for Biden. And for me, voting for Biden doesn't mean I like him. In fact, people are shocked to realize that I, as a black man, wasn't a really big fan of Obama. I like what he represents as a strong positive role model to Black children. That's a wonderful thing. But in terms of policy, Biden is even worse than that. It's not a matter of voting for Biden. It's a matter of beating Trump. That's what we got to do right now. And as a lawyer, I know the power of a president to mold the federal judiciary in his or her image. People think it's just the 9 Supreme Court justices that they appoint. No, it's the circuit courts of appeal. It's the district courts. You're talking about literally more than 1,000 positions. And these are lifetime appointments. So I got to give Trump's advisors great credit for being evil geniuses. They are appointing far right-wing lawyers in their 40s to the federal bench. So that means these 40-year-old lawyers are going to be around for the next 30 or 40 years. So I understand that I'm not going to get that socialist revolution I want in December. I understand that. So since I'm not going to get that in a classless society, what's the next best thing? What's the march toward that? So for me, it's what Brother Malcolm said. People think that in Malcolm X's speech, The Battle of the Bullet, that he meant the conjunction or, but if you really listen to it, he meant the conjunction and. It's the ballot and the bullet. And I want to be clear, by ballot, I don't just mean voting. I mean voting and putting pressure on the person you got elected. So it's a 1-2 punch. When I say the bullet doesn't mean ammunition, violence. It means that pressure. So when Malcolm talked about the ballot or the bullet, I'm saying the ballot and the bullet. The ballot is to vote, and the bullet is to put that pressure on the leftist, the progressive, the liberal candidate to get him, her, or them to move farther leftward.
What do you see as the role of people in the streets?
I had been meeting with the mayor, Mayor Jim Kenney, over the last year, year and a half, to try to negotiate the removal of the Rizzo statue. I went into the meetings where I talked to him on the phone. I got my suit and tie on, carrying my briefcase, being all professional and not really making headway. I got to give the mayor credit. He listened to me. He entertained me. We discussed, but there was no movement, no traction. All of a sudden, the activists take it to the streets. And the next day, that early morning, the Rizzo statue is gone. So for me, it's going back to that 1-2 punch thing. The activists on the street, they gotta light the spark. They gotta raise the hell. And once they light the spark and raise the hell, then they can pass the baton on to the lawyers and the progressives and the other folks at the table. But until the people on the street start making demands, nothing's gonna happen. The activists, the masses, gotta keep raising hell. If they don't, nothing will change, nothing.
Simply relying on voting to oust this regime will almost certainly lead to very bad, even disastrous results. We need the people in the streets raising demand.
Yes, that's more important than anything, because if the people don't move, the elected officials are not going to move. Political systems are, by definition, conservative. They want to conserve the status quo. They want to keep things as they are. They don't really want a revolution because they're benefiting. That's why the people on the street, the masses, got to push and push and push and yell and scream. So it's really on them. If they don't do it, nothing will get done.
That was attorney and writer Michael Cord. Follow him at Michael Cord. We're linking to his article, Trump's Fascism is Sprinting, Not Creeping, Toward Philly and Other Big Cities, in the show notes. Next, we'll hear from Coco Das and Carl Dix, editors of RefuseFascism.org, who held a live-streamed Q&A session earlier this week, as well as commentary on the September 5 mass nationwide protests from Sarah Rourke, another editor of RefuseFascism.org.
The election is only 91 days away. Why can't we just wait till then and then vote in big numbers? In November.
This regime needs to go now, and we have all the evidence of that. It actually is possible to force them out before the election. As far as timelines go, in Egypt, it took them 18 days to get Mubarak out. In Armenia, it was like something like 21, 25 days. Puerto Rico was like 15 days. When you have the right demand and you have momentum and you have people filling the streets, even highly entrenched regimes can go very quickly. There's also this cost of waiting. Even waiting 91 days after we waited 3.5 years has a cost, and most acutely that cost is what you will be forced to accept and what you might be forced to accept if they win, and what you become in that process. As Sarah Rourke has said and written about, what you accept is not only what you condone, it's what you become. You may not have a chance to vote in epic numbers. Last week, Trump tweeted that he thinks maybe we should delay the elections. There's a whole process in place of gerrymandering, voter suppression. The Electoral College allowed him to come to power in 2016, even though he lost the popular vote. If we're waiting for the election to not happen, or we're waiting for him to subvert or steal the election, we're going to be blindsided if we do not get in the streets now and create the conditions where the whole world can see that the people in this country do not accept the legitimacy of this regime.
If you're saying we should wait till the election and then vote him out, you have missed the nature of the threat that this regime poses to humanity. The actual consolidation of a fascist regime. Imagine that you were in Nazi Germany and the question of driving Hitler's regime out gets posed a couple of months before the second election, because he won two elections, neither by a majority of the vote, by the way. And you said, well, let's wait and see if we can get him in the election. Think of what history has shown us about that. Look at the horrors that came down the pike. That is looming in the face of humanity. And we have to actually recognize the threat of a fascist regime fully consolidating its hold on power and unleashing even greater horrors than we have seen up to now. That's what we have to look at. And we have to look at the fact that the other side is building up towards the elections. You know, people say, well, Trump doesn't seem to have a good strategy. Well, he's not running an electoral strategy. He is running a fascist strategy, and he is building up his base, activating his stormtroopers, unleashing them on the other side, laying out that he's looking to mobilize vote monitors, which will actually be fascist thugs who are out there to intimidate people who they expect won't vote for them. In the face of all that, why would you say, let's wait for the election and see if we can vote them out? We can't play this by the normal rules and norms that things function. We have to bring the power that we actually have, and that power is in the streets, in mass, nonviolent protest.
One thing I would want to add is that elections may end up being one component of stopping Trump, but the way that fascism advances is by subverting every single norm, subverting and actually eviscerating all of the normal channels. So relying on that, waiting for that without a mass movement from below is going to turn out like all of the other normal channels have. Look what happened with impeachment. When people, there was a chance for people to get into the streets in mass numbers and say, Trump must resign. But that didn't happen. And that turned into not only a dead end, but an actual mechanism for them to even seize more power. Every one of these norms are being eviscerated and shredded up. And that includes shredding up the electoral norms.
Doesn't the demand Black Lives Matter encompass the demand for Trump Pence out now? And then connected to that, but really its own question, why is Trump Pence out now the central demand? Is that hijacking the movement for Black lives?
It is very righteous and very powerful and very beautiful that large numbers of people from diverse backgrounds went into the streets after the murder of George Floyd, fighting not only for justice in that particular case and for victims of police murder and police brutality overall, but also bringing forward the demand to end white supremacy and the institutionalized racism that has always been a part of American society from the very, very beginning. This regime is not going to pack up and leave. And we just spoke to why you can't wait for the elections to take care of it. It's not hijacking a movement to raise that and the struggle with people to take that approach. Because it really is the case that if you really want to see white supremacy ended, if you really want to see an end to murder by police, then you actually have to take up and join the struggle to drive this regime out, to drive it from power, because you've got a regime headed up by an open, naked white supremacist. If that regime is able to consolidate its hold on power, one thing you can be sure of is that white supremacy will not be ended as long as they're in power. You're not going to get an end to police brutalizing and murdering Black and brown people. And the same holds true for the just and righteous demand of stopping the devastation of the planet we live on, ending attacks against immigrants, and all the other just demands that have motivated people. We need to drive this regime from power.
I agree with Carl. Removing this regime from power is not hijacking that movement. It's offering an accelerant to it actually achieving anything. You actually have to look at movements around the world and what happens when you have a demand that the regime must go. Very quickly, can lead to a situation where there's momentum built up and the ruling forces in power want to resolve that crisis in the streets, and they force the leader out or they force the regime out. But there's also the opposite example where movements go on for a long time, bring a lot of people into the streets. Protest in the streets is very powerful. It is our power. But when the regime has the power to re-seize the initiative, as soon as they're able to, they do it. There is a momentum to these things, and there is a chance that movements, as righteous as they are, can fizzle out. And in those situations, what happens is you don't go back to the way things were. The government, the regime in power, has learned their lesson. They will aim to knock the knees out from under you and to prevent your ability to stand up again.
So this is a question that I know I have gotten from people in the left. Aren't the Democrats just as bad as the Republicans?
I think what we're confronting here is this fascism or is it more of the same? What this Republican Party represents is a complete commitment to undoing the social progress of the last 50 years. I hear this from various points on the left. Aren't the Democrats just as bad? Hasn't America always been white supremacist? And my answer to this is it's a fascist leap that's deeply rooted in American history, which the Democrats have also participated in a system of white supremacy and in a country based on slavery and genocide. But the Republican Party, if you look at the continuity of this history, I think of it as a break in that continuity came in the 60s when the Black liberation movement, women's liberation movement, gay liberation, all these movements for liberation actually made some advances and we actually got some progress in society. And it's taken these fascist forces 50 years to reconsolidate into something that can actually seize power. But their goal is actually to undo this social progress of the last 50 years. They do want to make America white again. They have declared war on LGBT people. They want women to not have the right to birth control and abortion. Then there's this whole Christian fascist element, which has been on the rise over the last 50 years, which actually wants a Christian theocratic state based on the Bible taken literally. Those are not things that the Democrats are fighting for. You know, they may be things that they concede with or conciliate with. They may be weak on those things. They're not fighting to undo that progress, but the Republican Party is. That is what the fascist program is based on. It's actually resurrecting this whole history of white supremacy. It's celebrating this manifest destiny genocidal dominance over all these other groups. You also have to look at what is being transformed. What are the norms that the Democratic Party is adhering to? And what are the norms that are being torn up by the Republican Party? And we might argue about what those norms are and how much those norms do for the people. The Republican Party is actually changing the form of rule in this country. And the Democratic Party is adhering to these norms that have contributed to some very bad things happening to people. If you say that the Democrats are just as bad as the Republicans and therefore I'm not going to do anything about this fascist regime in power, you are actually being complicit and making a grave mistake. And I don't think that history will look kindly upon it.
The Democratic Party is a ruling class party, just like the Republican Party on that score. They both represent and are working to keep in effect the system of capitalism imperialism, which is the source of all the horrors that people face here and around the world. But they have different programs for how that should be done. And the Republican Party is united around and pushing forward a fascist agenda as the way to keep the system in effect. And what that comes down to is that they are pushing for a different form of capitalist imperialist rule is needed to keep this system in effect. And that different form requires breaking with democratic rights and liberties that people have, busting through gains that people have won, driving things back. Where the difference comes in is from the perspective of fighting to stop these horrors. One of those ruling class parties is saying we need to discard these rules and norms which have granted people some space to fight this. And that's the Republican Party that's doing that.
I think that both of you really got at whether people are willing to really look at this crisis that is before us of the consolidation of fascism and what the implications of that are. I think more people need to be convinced this will work, this being nonviolent mass-sustained protests. How do we convince people? What would Coco and Carl say are the three key things to making a leap in people connecting to Out Now on a scale qualitatively more massive? Why do you think more people aren't in the streets raising this demand? If Trump is talking about delaying the elections, why can't we talk about moving them up sooner? Wouldn't that be better?
The last few months, especially the protests that emerged over May and June after the murder of George Floyd, and then what we saw in Portland, does show you why this could work, because every force in society had to start responding to it. You actually did change the debate more in 3 weeks of protests than you did in 3 years of sitting back. I think that there's historical evidence. There's evidence in different countries of how this worked. And we've seen also that the people in this country can hit the streets day in and day out, and they can become part of a movement that is not provoked and doesn't back down. What remains is, what do we actually do about this problem that's looming of a fascist regime that's getting ready to consolidate power? So I think the recognition that this is fascist is one of the key things. I think really embracing and understanding our power to stop this with sustained nonviolent mass protest that demands Trump ends Out Now. That's the other key thing. I think the third key thing is the moral question. You know, what kind of person do you want to be? And how is history going to look back on your actions?
Let me start with the last question. Why can't we move the election sooner since Trump is trying to do them later? Well, that misses where our power is. We actually don't have the power to move the election sooner. I mean, and frankly, by law, Trump doesn't have the power to move them later. However, he does have the executive power, and he can do a whole lot to disrupt the functioning of government if the regime feels like that serves their interest in staying in power. We have to look at where our power is, and our power is in going to the streets. This is a time where we need to do that, because you already have kids in concentration camps on the border. You already have a Muslim ban. You already have a judiciary that's stacked to roll back advances that have been fought for and won in the past. All of that is already in place. This is what we're up against. And think about what that means if this regime stays in power. You go from a situation where that begins to happen to where it becomes the norm. This is where things could end up very soon. And we have to say, are we going to sit back and let this happen? It really is a question of what kind of person, what kind of human being are you going to be? Are you going to be one who looks at this stuff and says, well, this isn't right, but what could I do about it? And then it does come down to seeing that we have power. And that power is in the streets, that's mainly where we have power that can affect things. Coco is right to talk about in 3 weeks, more has been done on the question of dealing with police terror than 3 years of sitting back and watching it happen, because George Floyd wasn't the first video that people saw of someone being murdered by the police.
I want to bring into the conversation Sarah Rourke to talk a little bit more about September 5th.
Hi, everyone. Labor Day is traditionally a marker day in the American calendar. And we are looking at a very unusual Labor Day here. It's not going to feel like a normal Labor Day because it isn't. And it's not a normal year. It's not a normal presidential term. It's not a normal anything. But this is an opportunity for us where people are going to be noticing how not normal it is. Even the ones who've been trying to keep their heads turned away are going to have trouble with it if they have kids, if they have dependents, if they're a teacher. Teachers are making out their wills. Kids are at risk. Elders are at risk. People in jobs where they're being forced to go to work are at risk. This is going to be brought home to people in an even more solid way as we go into September 5th. So we decided at Refuse Fascism that this was an opportunity that we can't let pass. This is not done until we've removed the regime. The fascism that we are refusing is here. Trump and Pence literally meet the textbook. I'm speaking here of Robert Paxton, but also Umberto Eco and other scholars of fascism. Their definition of fascism applies to Trump Pence. They haven't managed to completely fully consolidate their rule, or we wouldn't be able to protest at all. But I think things like the kidnapping people off the street into unmarked vans is starting to wake a whole new circle of people up to the fact that we are farther along in that consolidation than we wanted to admit. And what we're going to be trying to bring to people at this moment, this juncture where people's vision might be a little bit broader than it normally is, we're going to try and wake imagination. The failure of imagination that has been keeping this nation paralyzed while Trump and Pence consolidate their rule. And I mean both a failure to imagine the consequences of what we know is going on if we don't stop it. Now we even have late night hosts who are willing to use the word fascism to describe what's going on. And yet, people using the word fascism still don't go the next step of, well, if that is what is happening, then what do we have to do? And what happens if we don't do it? What happens to real people? Politics is about what actually happens to real people, starting with the most vulnerable. So we have to awaken people to that, but we also have to awaken people to the power that we have, to the history of successful, nonviolent mass revolutions in removing even decades-old regimes. We have to remind people of the immense power that the recent Black Lives Matter protests and anti-police brutality, anti-police militarization protests have had, even as they've been getting viciously repressed. And of course, the reason that they are getting so viciously repressed is because they are powerful. They pose a threat to this regime. And the more peaceful they are, the more of a threat they pose. But that's exactly why we have to double down on the peaceful, nonviolent, mass-sustained protest that does not allow business as usual to continue. What if it wasn't just the people who were out there now? That's what we're doing on Labor Day while attention is widened. We need to reach out to all kinds of groups, all kinds of people. It's going to take all of us. It can't just be the radical left. It can't just be the moderate left. It can't just be Democrats. It can't just be people of color. It has to be really a broad section of the public. There are obstacles. Some of the problems that we've run into is that failure of solidarity. We're finding that people view this demand as a distraction to what they think is the important thing, whatever their cause is. You know, if it's the environment, if it's racial justice, if it's women's rights, there's sort of a view that you can't support this demand and support all these other movements too, which is the opposite of the truth. The truth is that none of this can get fixed under a fascist regime. We need to realize that while removing Trump and Pence will not fix all the dire, desperate things that need to be fixed in our system, they are a precondition. Removing them is a necessary precondition. Right now, we are watching them try to rig the election in advance. If they don't succeed in rigging it, then they're going to try to delegitimize it. At the final stage, he may very well refuse to transfer power. And even Democratic electeds are admitting to that being a real possibility now. So what we have to do on Labor Day is awaken as broad a section of the people as we can to that danger and to that opportunity, and to the fact that while we all have many interests, many needs, that are all crucial human needs and rights, none of these things can be improved under a fascist regime. Fascists don't make things better for anybody except fascists. Hopefully that gives some idea of what's going on and why Labor Day, why this milestone in the American year is a worthy time to try to have that spark of awakening kindled.
Thanks for tuning in to Inside Without Now. Be sure to subscribe to get the latest. As we just discussed, RefuseFascism.org is mobilizing for nationwide united mass protests demanding Trump-Pence out now on September 5. We're staying in the streets all this month to build for these protests. We're urging all available supporters on the East Coast to be part of the Trump-Pence Out Now contingent in the Get Your Knee Off Our Necks March on Washington, Friday, August 28th. If you're on the East Coast, I hope to see you there. Sign up to join us at refusefascism.org. To spread the demand Trump-Pence Out Now, right now, donate. You can Venmo Refuse-Fascism, or give via Cash App, Refuse Fascism, or go to the website, refusefascism.org. Follow at Refuse Fascism on social media and join us in raising the demand. Trump-Pence out now. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. See you in the streets real soon.